August 1917 was brutally hot in Brooklyn. The heat spell killed 272 people in the city's most populated borough. Residents would do just about anything to cool off. Families that could afford it checked into the better hotels in town, those with electricity, in order to enjoy the blessed relief of an electric fan. Early that month, more than 100,000 people spent the night sleeping on the beach at Coney Island, fighting off the mosquitoes and the sand fleas. The intense heat caused a stoppage on Brooklyn's elevated lines when crews walked off the job because of the sweltering weather. Young Brooklyn thug Al Capone took a cab to Coney Island. As he traveled down Ocean Parkway, he wasn't surprised to see people practically living on the sidewalks trying to get a breath of fresh air. He sat in the back seat, enjoying the light breeze from the open windows on his way to the Harvard Inn, a club that belonged to Capone's employer, gangster Frankie Yale. It wasn't much of a job, he was just a glorified bouncer, but he saw it as a way to work himself up someday to making dough for himself. When he made it to Coney Island, Capone had the driver turn down a side street in order to avoid the heavy traffic on Surf Avenue. Dubbed the poor man's Riviera, the street was a paradise for those seeking relief from the heat. He had the cabbie drop him off at Neptune Avenue, around a block from the club, and walked the brightly lit street that was experiencing the usual traffic jam created by automobiles loaded with fun seekers circling the streets in search of parking. Capone wore a light blue suit and a white shirt with a collar and cuffs. He also wore a new straw hat on his sweaty head to try and shield his head from the blazing August sun. He hoped it would be a little cooler down here by the beach, but on this night, he was perspiring more than he did during the day. Perhaps it was because of the crowded sidewalks and the steam generated by the concession stands that were strung along the way, or maybe it was the countless electric bulbs that covered just about every inch of space where someone wasn't walking. Capone removed his hat and wiped his brow with the back of his hand and slipped into the rear door of the Harvard Inn, which hadn't yet opened to the public for the night. He hurried past the hot kitchen to one of the coolest places in the club, underneath a large overhead fan near the pool room. Looking around the club, he was surprised to find a small group of customers already in the darkened space being served drinks. He knew they couldn't be guests of the owner since he knew Frankie was out of town. When he asked a bartender, he was told they were friends of Albert Altieri, a local hood. Capone didn't think much of Altieri, but since the inn was supposed to open in only 20 minutes, he decided to ignore them. Well, he ignored the men in the party. It was hard to miss one of the two young ladies in the group. They got up from the table to use the powder room, and Capone's eyes nearly popped out of their sockets as he watched one of the girls who was wearing a bright yellow dress sashay by as she walked to the front where the restrooms were located. He kept his eyes on the door to the ladies' room, waiting for it to open and for the pretty girl to cross the empty dance floor on her way back to the table. He pretended to be making a slight adjustment to the curtain near the foyer and raised his head when she approached him. "And how are you this fine evening?" he asked her in his smoothest, most polite tone of voice. She swept past Capone without responding to his advance, avoiding all eye contact and making him feel like a fool. He cursed himself under his breath for using this approach to try and establish a claim on her before other young men showed up and offered competition. The girl sat back down at the table next to a short man who was double-fisting rye whiskey and beer. The hard-drinking man was Frank Galluccio, and his normally neat appearance was out of whack by the fact that his shirt was untucked from his trousers and his tie was unknotted and hanging halfway down his chest. This man, who turned out to be a low-level associate of Lucky Luciano, became well-known later in life as a kind man who helped out the friends and neighbors who were down on their luck. But tonight, he was drinking up a storm. The good news, as far as Capone was concerned, was the girl in the yellow dress didn't seem to be the guy's date. The date was apparently the tall, skinny girl who was seated on the other side of him. While the evening's band, the Highlights, were unpacking their instruments on the stage, Capone noticed Galluccio boost himself up from his chair and head for the restroom. So he decided to try a different tack. After all, the Beauty in the Yellow Dress must be a third wheel, just a friend of the couple. Maybe if Capone could cozy up to Galluccio, he'd wrangle an introduction to the girl. But that plan didn't go much better than his first one. Galluccio was half drunk and brushed off his friendly approach. But Capone saw another opening when the music started, and Galluccio and his date headed for the dance floor. Capone decided to take advantage of the opening to speak to the girl who'd been left sitting at the table. He sat down in an empty chair and tried to engage her in conversation. "Do you like ragtime?" Capone asked, nodding toward the band. The girl just looked at him blankly, blinked, and turned her head to blow out a cloud of smoke from her cigarette. "Look, fella," she said in a bored voice, "I'm not going to sit here and recite my musical preferences to you, so please leave before they get back." But Capone wasn't giving up. "Well, I know you like music because I've noticed you tapping your lovely feet under the table. It's been such a hot day and the ocean's beautiful at night. I bet you wouldn't mind a little stroll on the beach with me later on." But the girl snapped at him. "The number's nearly over, fella. Would you be kind enough to leave now?" Capone's failure to impress her was still no reason for him to admit defeat. He'd walk away like a gentleman after a rejection, but his massive ego allowed him to believe he still had a chance. In fact, he was steaming when a bit later, he noticed one of the club's regulars steer the object of Capone's lust out onto the dance floor. The band was playing a slow tune and Capone watched the pair from the doorway that led to the kitchen. When the number was over, the couple passed him as they walked back to their table. When they drew close to where he was standing, Capone leaned over toward the girl and quietly spoke. "I'd still like to take you on that walk to the beach." She barely looked at him as she walked past, but Capone didn't care. He had a short conference with the band leader requesting a special tune for a special friend. Moments later, the Highlights blared out the first notes of a song that went, "By the sea, by the beautiful sea." The girl turned out to be Lena. And as she returned to the table to tell Frank Galluccio, who was her brother, what Capone had said to her on the way back from the dance floor, Galluccio didn't like it. He told the two girls to use the ladies' room by the rear exit. If any trouble started, they were to slip out the door and wait for him in front of the funhouse. Lena urged Frank to ignore the insulting brute and take them home. It was getting late, but Galluccio wasn't hearing her. He was going to have a word with Capone. Eventually, the reluctant girls gave in and began strolling toward the powder room. They were convinced Frank would talk to Capone and it would be over. But then what Capone said to Lena on her way out became the last straw. He stepped in between the two women and whispered to her in a raspy voice, "I'll tell you one thing. You do have a lovely ass, and I mean that as a compliment." Galluccio, drunk as he was, had still managed to follow the girl's exit with presence of mind until the rising anger inside of him reached its boiling point. And when he saw his sister's face turn beet red from something Capone said to her, Frank was ready to jump up and deal with the other man, but decided to hold his ground instead. Meanwhile, Capone, still thinking he could win over Lena's brother by buying him some drinks, ordered the bartender to send a round to his table. Galluccio, though, refused the drinks. Instead, he kept his hands busy under the table. "Come over here." He gestured to Capone with his left hand. Capone went, not expecting trouble. He was trying to cozy up to the guy, not fight him. Galluccio remained seated with one hand behind him, holding on to the back of the chair and the other hand under the table, clutching a knife. Capone walked toward him with both hands outstretched and palms up as a symbol of friendly intent. Before Capone could react, Galluccio was on his feet, tossing the chair he held in his hand along the floor in the bigger man's direction. Capone tried to jump out of the way of the chair, but his feet became entangled with the legs. He lost his balance and he fell, face down, onto the sawdust-covered floor. At the moment Capone hit the deck, Galluccio jumped on his back. He slashed at Capone's neck 3 times with a knife, attempting to sever his jugular, while Capone tried without success to flip himself over and grab hold of his attacker. The conflict lasted only a few seconds. Galluccio, thinking he killed Capone, stood up, took a quick look at the patrons who watched the chaos in horror, made a quick dash for the exit, and vanished into the crowded street. A bartender rushed over, too late to be of any help to Capone, except to compress the wounds with bar towels and see to it that he was driven to the nearby Coney Island Hospital to attend to 3 slashes, the worst of which was on the side of his face. Capone survived, but the fight left brutal scars on his cheek and neck, which would be with him for the rest of his life. They also managed to give Capone the one nickname that he hated above all others, pushed on him by the cops and the papers. Scarface, they called him, but they never used the moniker in front of him. No matter who you were, if Capone heard it, there was a good chance you'd end up dead. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our brand new season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties, an era of gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, corrupt cops, and the ghosts those violent days left behind. We'll be telling the true story of the man who personified the era more than any other, Al Capone, a man who rose to the top spot of the criminal underworld when he was just 25 years old, ruling over a city filled with speakeasies, brothels, and gambling joints, and an army made up of assassins, gunmen, dirty cops, and city officials. But even with all his power, Capone was a man who lived in fear, haunted by a vengeful spirit that was determined to follow him to the grave. This is episode 1, the first episode of season 10, Capone. Alphonse Capone was born in Brooklyn, New York on January 17, 1899. His father, Gabriel, a barber from Naples, Italy, and his mother, Teresa, had come to America in 1893, exchanging the slums of Naples for the slums of Brooklyn's Navy Yard district. The family's name, Capone, was an Americanization of the original Capone. They settled in an apartment on Navy Street in the chaos of the borough's largest Italian neighborhood. Rent in the brick and wood frame tenements ran around $4 a month, and none of the flats had heat, running water, or indoor bathrooms. After working as a grocer briefly, Gabriel opened a barber shop at 69 Park Avenue, a short distance from his home. He and his wife eventually had 7 sons and 2 daughters. Vincenzo, who later went by the name James, Ralph, who'd later end up with the nickname Bottles because he wore thick glasses, Salvatore, who went by Frank, Amadio, who was renamed John but had a family nickname of Mimi, Umberto, who became Albert, Matthew, Rose, their oldest daughter, and the baby, Mafalda, who was named for Italy's royal princess. The Capones were just like thousands of other poor, uneducated Italians who started pouring into the country in the 1880s. The Italians had a more challenging time assimilating than other immigrants of the era. Southern Italian peasants and craftsmen made up most of the new arrivals, and they were clannish and wary of outsiders. Centuries of problems caused by foreign invaders and officials from their own government taught them to mistrust authority. Police and politicians were considered enemies. They believed the laws had been made to protect the rich and exploit the poor, and tended to place loyalty to family and community above everything else, including their adopted country. For this reason, they didn't necessarily look down on those who broke the law, even the gangsters and racketeers, if they were loyal to their people and, above all, were good family men. The hardship and prejudice endured by Italian immigrants confirmed their suspicions about America. Thanks to a lack of formal education, inability to master the language, and their past employment limited to farming and shopkeeping, they found that only the lowest paying jobs were available to them. They became ditch diggers, bricklayers, and stone cutters. They laid pipes and railroad ties, sold rags from street carts, ran small fruit and vegetable stands, and like Gabriel Capone, they used scissors and razors to put food on the table. But what these jobs paid was not enough, so a man's wife and children worked too. Teresa Capone, a quiet, strong woman, worked as a dressmaker, and most of the children worked odd jobs before their teens. Years of hard labor in the old country allowed most immigrants to withstand the hardship of city slums, but the children's health suffered. Undernourished, overcrowded, and dingy cold water tenements, and lacking proper sanitation, clean water, fresh air, and sunlight, the first generation Italians were the sickest group in turn-of-the-century New York City. The infant mortality rate was almost double that of the rest of the population, with the leading killers being respiratory diseases, diarrhea, and diphtheria. Italians were the most illiterate of immigrant groups, and because their children had to go to work, very few of them ever made it to high school. That would change with the second generation, which was forced to attend public school, but during the boyhood of the Capone brothers, illiteracy was, along with truancy, very common. Except for Matt, the youngest brother, none of the Capones ever finished high school. The Italians also faced a stereotype that claimed they were prone to criminal behavior. Mayor Joseph Shakespeare of New Orleans, another city flooded with thousands of Italian immigrants, wrote that Italians and Sicilians were, quote, the most idle, vicious, and worthless people among us. Many in New York shared this view, although in most cases it was not true. Honestly, based on the lousy jobs they were forced to work and the many prejudices against them, it's a surprise that more Italians didn't engage in a life of crime. But those that did got a lot of attention. Some young immigrant men working hard for little pay discovered that crime offered them the opportunities their parents had been promised when they'd been invited to America. They joined the ranks of professional gunmen and extortionists, vice peddlers, labor racketeers, gambling house operators, and bootleggers. But even then, these men were in the minority. They were only a small part of the Italian immigrant population, and yet their mere presence reinforced the prejudices that so many had about them being dirty, mentally inferior gangsters. These prejudices only caused the Italian-American community to draw even more tightly together. The sense of community ran so deep among some Italians, they were likely to keep in touch all their lives, no matter how widely their careers diverged. This often explains why the pallbearers at a gangster's funeral included judges, district attorneys, and priests, and why at testimonial dinners for a retiring city official, police inspectors may sit next to hardened gunmen. This was the world that shaped the life of Al Capone. Even though he often considered himself an outsider with little interest in his foreign roots. "I'm no Italian," he often said. "I'm from Brooklyn." He didn't care about Sicily or Naples. He was born in New York and baptized at St. Michael's Church, just a block from his parents' home. Life in the neighborhood where Capone spent his first 10 years was rough, but never dull. Hordes of ragged children could be found playing stickball, dodging traffic, and running wild as their mothers, dark women with thick black hair, walked the streets with baskets on their head that were filled with groceries for the day's meals. Fruit and vegetable carts lined the curb, and the completion of the Williamsburg Bridge in 1903, the greatest suspension bridge in the world at the time, brought hordes of people to the area looking for cheap housing. During the warm weather months, the corner of Sands and Navy Streets was often the scene of music shows attended by hundreds of people. It was during these shows that Capone acquired his passion for Italian opera. But it was Sand Street that catered to other tastes at night, as sailors came ashore looking for liquor and women. It was one of the roughest areas in the city where murder and mayhem constantly occurred. The bars were filled with drunken sailors stacked 3 and 4 deep, and if their money ran low, some of the pawn shops stayed open all night. There were tattoo parlors, gambling dens, dance halls, fleabag hotels that rented rooms by the hour, and a legion of sex workers who were always available. Capone's schooling began near Sand Street at PS No. 7 on Adams Street. His teacher, a 16-year-old girl named Sadie Mulvaney, had received her training from Catholic nuns, and despite her young age and general unworldliness, she managed to keep order among some of the toughest boys in the neighborhood. One of them was Salvatore Luciano, who would later become known in life as Charles Lucky Luciano. He and Capone took to each other, and they remained lifelong friends. Sadie Mulvaney would later remember Capone as a, quote, swarthy, sullen, troublesome boy. But he was no more trouble than her other students. He was big and strong for his age, quick to anger, and would fly into a murderous rage when provoked. After school, Capone liked to hang around the docks and never tired of watching the change of the U.S. Marine Guards at the main Navy gate. The recruits, many of them new, had to march in drill formation before they could be relieved. If a raw recruit was out of step, their corporal would keep the entire detail marching until the blunderer caught on. One afternoon, Capone, who was 10 years old but looked about 14, came to the gate with several friends. After watching the whole routine for several weeks, he understood the corporal's strategy. On this occasion, there was one particularly inept guard who, even after 3 or 4 minutes, still didn't understand what was going on. After several minutes, Capone called out to the man, told him to get in step because he was holding up his comrades. The recruit finally managed the steps and the detail was dismissed. But burning with anger, the red-faced recruit charged up to the fence, looking as if he planned to spit at Capone. Al flew into a rage and challenged him to a fight, even though the guardsman was twice his size. The corporal intervened and ordered the recruit back to the guardhouse. He told Capone that if the young man had spit on him, he would have put him on report. But Capone told him not to. He said that if the Marine stepped outside the gate, he'd take care of him himself. He walked away with his fists clenched and his face red with anger. Not long after, the corporal discussed the cocky Italian boy with the sergeant of the guards. He said, quote, "If this kid had a good Marine officer to get a hold of him and steer him right, he'd make a good man for the Marines. But if nothing like this happens, the kid may drift for a few years until some wise guy picks him up and steers him around. And then he'll be heard from one day." The corporal's prophecy came true much sooner than he likely imagined. Capone fell under the influence of an older gangster named John Torrio, who'd been born in Naples in 1882. By the time he met Capone, he'd already established himself as an underworld figure of some note. Torrio, who stood no higher than Capone's upper chest, was a small, pale man who seemed to be mild-mannered and quiet. But looks could be deceiving. He'd belonged to Manhattan's famous Five Points gang for 7 years until the bloodthirsty hoodlums began to dwindle in ranks, headed for either prison or the grave. He then joined another gang with headquarters in a saloon that he ran on James Street. He made a name for himself as a calm, reflective man, but he had no compunctions about murder and would order the execution of an enemy without hesitation, even though he himself never carried out the violence. Torrio claimed he'd never fired a gun in his life and had practical objections to most violence. He considered it a poor solution to business problems and preferred alliances, meetings, and diplomacy. There was, Torrio believed, enough money in the rackets for all to share in peace without risking injury or death. Torrio, in his heyday, was the closest thing in the underworld to a criminal mastermind from the pages of detective fiction. His methods quickly influenced his young protege, and Capone often remarked that by imitating Torrio, he solved many problems without bloodshed. In 1907, the Capones moved to another Italian neighborhood about a mile south of Navy Street. The entire family moved into the flat on the second floor of a cold water tenement at 38 Garfield Place. All but James made the move with them. He'd vanished. At the age of 16, and it would be many years before the family learned what had happened to him. Al maintained contact with his friend John Torrio. At the corner of 4th Avenue and Union Street, above a restaurant within sight of Garfield Place, Torrio started a social club with his name in gilt letters on the window. DePone passed by the place every day on his way to school. Capone had started the second grade at PS number 113 on Butler Street, 6 blocks from his home. He maintained a B average up to 6th grade when he fell behind in math and grammar, mostly due to skipping class and had to repeat the grade. The year he turned 14, he missed 33 days out of a possible 90, and when his teacher admonished him for skipping class, he got angry and smacked her. After then being thrashed by the principal, he quit school, never to return. He worked sporadically as a clerk in a candy store, then as a pen setter in a bowling alley, and finally as a paper and cloth cutter in a bookbindery. There was a pool room at 20 Garfield Place where Capone and his father both played, and Al spent so much time there, he became the neighborhood champion. With time on his hands, Capone liked to wander and found he couldn't roam too far from home without crossing into territory run by various street gangs. The era was divided up between various factions of Italians, the Irish, and the Jews, all of whom regularly fought battles that ended in bloodshed. The gangs were attractive to the young men and boys of the immigrant slums. They offered an escape and a feeling of society they didn't find in school, church, or the workplace. The boys formed their own society with the gangs, in which they pursued the thrills of shared adventure, engaging in horseplay, gambling, stealing, vandalizing, drinking, smoking, and fighting with rival groups. And not all the gangs were criminal. Some developed into social or athletic clubs approved and assisted by adults in the community. For many boys, though, it was a small step from random mischief maker to professional criminal. Practically every racketeer, Capone included, spent his formative years in a street gang. Nearly every gang enjoyed the protection of a political ward boss. Even if they weren't old enough to vote, they rendered valuable resources like intimidating voters, kidnapping candidates, and stealing ballot boxes. The ward bosses spared no expense in securing these allies. They leased clubhouses for them, bought them sports equipment and uniforms, and gave them steak dinners, picnics, and tickets to ball games and prize fights. If a gang member was arrested, he could count on his ward boss to furnish bail and a lawyer, and if convicted, to get his sentence reduced or dismissed altogether. The gang that Capone and Lucky Luciano joined as teenagers was the Five Points Gang, to which Torrio introduced them both. The gang was based on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, an area that lay between Broadway and the Bowery and present-day Chinatown on the Lower East Side. It was a place of gambling houses, brothels, and crime. Various religious groups had attempted to reform the district, but to no avail. The district was at the heart of the Bloody Old Sixth Ward, as it was called, which had a notorious reputation for political corruption. One glaring example was an election in which the number of ballots received was higher than the number of actual registered voters in the area at the time. For nearly a century, Five Points had spawned the most brutal gangs to ever terrorize New York. Among them were the 40 Thieves, formed in 1825. The Shirt Tails followed them, so named because they wore the shirts outside of their trousers. The Plug Uglies were Irishmen who protected their heads in combat with leather plug hats, who felled their victims with clubs and then stomped them to death with hobnailed boots. And then there were the Dead Rabbits, whose name didn't come from an animal, but from the slang term for a thief, which was rabbit. After the Civil War, the Wyos formed. Legend gave the origin of the name to a cry they uttered while fighting. Membership in the gang required a recruit to commit at least one homicide, because murder was their primary source of business. They had a price list for the murder and mayhem they were willing to commit, ranging from $2 for a beating and $100 for an actual death. The Wyos eventually became the Five Points Gang, which was in its heyday around the turn of the last century, under the leadership of a former prize fighter named Paul Kelly. From the New Brighton Dance Hall, a club he owned on Great Jones Street, he directed operations for more than 1,500 gang members. A quiet, cultured man, Kelly was better educated than most gangsters of his day. He spoke English, Italian, French, and Spanish, and was always dressed with great style. No gang leader could keep his power if he didn't prove himself politically useful, and the notoriously corrupt Tammany Hall was in debt to Kelly for the many times when his men supported its candidates on election day. By the time Capone joined the Five Points Gang, Kelly no longer had the prestige he once had. Years of warfare with Monk Eastman's Bowery Boys gang had strained his resources, and then his lieutenant, Biff Ellison, attempted a takeover of the gang that left a bodyguard dead and Kelly with three bullets in his body. He survived the attack, though, and later moved to Harlem, where he set up a new racket organizing labor unions. The Five Points kept its core group of hard men to set up a joint on 7th Avenue called the New Englander Social and Dramatic Club. While the name seemed innocent, what went on there was anything but tame. The police repeatedly raided the club after reports of knifings, beatings, and shootings, and while arrests were sometimes made, the charges never stuck. Capone was arrested three times during his days with the Five Points Gang, once for disorderly conduct and twice for suspicion of murder. But no evidence was ever produced to support the charges. The remaining Five Points men all maintained strong affiliations with other gangs and gang leaders. John Torrio and his friends often worked with Brooklyn gangster Frankie Yale. At the time, Yale was only 25 years old and was already making his mark in the rackets. Before long, he would dominate them. His specialty was murder contracts, and he was quick to admit it. "I'm an undertaker," he often said. But he had his finger in a lot of things. He owned a club, the Harvard Inn, on Coney Island, and the nearby beach turned out to be a strategic location during Prohibition. He was the first New York gangster to distribute liquor from rum runners who cruised the coast. He also rented out gunmen for labor management disputes, working as either strikemakers or union goons. He forced Brooklyn tobacco shops to stock cigars of his own cheap manufacture. His portrait appeared on each box, and soon, a Frankie Yale came to be a slang term for a bad cigar. Racehorses, prize fighters, nightclubs, and a gangland funeral parlor were all part of Yale's operations, but his single greatest source of power and profit was the Unione Siciliani. Over the years, the organization has been described as everything from a secret criminal society with close ties to the mafia to a much maligned fraternal order. It eventually became a sort of twisted combination of both. In the late 1800s, the Unione Siciliani originated in New York as a lawful fraternal organization, the first to advance the interests of Sicilian immigrants. For modest dues, its members received life insurance and various social benefits, and branches began to spring up everywhere there was a sizable Sicilian community. Gradually, the organization developed enough strength to swing local elections, which is probably how it first gained the attention of gangsters. Soon, a group of New York racketeers began infiltrating the group. Their leader was Ignazio Sieta, known as Lupo the Wolf, a bloodthirsty killer and leader in the Black Hand extortion rings of the early 1900s. Through maneuvers that started in New York and extending out to branches in other cities like Chicago, the organization acquired a dual purpose. One side was a respectable society that helps needy Sicilians, and the other was a crime fraternity that specialized in white slavery, extortion, kidnapping, racketeering, and murder. It became common for the president of the association to be a gangster. Over a six-year period, the U.S. Secret Service traced 60 murders to members of the organization. Sieta himself maintained a murder stable in Harlem with meat hooks on which he hung his victims and a furnace in which he burned their remains. According to one of the only members that police could persuade to talk, recruits had to submit to a blood ritual to become part of the inner circle. Led to an altar, the recruit had to prick his finger with a stiletto and swear fidelity and secrecy to the organization. The reputable officers of the Unione Siciliani, the Businessmen, judges, and city and state officials claimed to know nothing about how the gangsters were exploiting it. They owed the association too great of a debt to endanger it. The frequent fundraising functions of the organization provided opportunities for the politicians and businessmen to meet and make deals with people in whose company they couldn't ordinarily be seen, which allowed them to make even more money, which seemed legitimate. In the 1920s, hoping to shed the unfortunate image it had gained, the society attempted to distance itself from its disreputable side. Officials claimed to be disheartened by rumors that the organization bred crime and disorder. Executive Officer Constantino Vitello wrote, "Our officers are strong business and professional men. Our members are honest Americans. The Constitution of the Unione, strictly enforced, declares that no man who has a blot on his character may enter, and those who are approved to have committed a felonious act while members may be expelled." Well, at the time this statement was issued, Frankie Yale had been the national head of the organization for nearly a decade. So, nope, no gangsters here. Yale hired Capone as a bouncer and a doorman for the Harvard Inn, a position which suited the young man. When required to break up a fight in the dance hall, he was more than happy to use a club, his meaty fists, or a gun if one was needed. It was at the Harvard Inn that Capone had earned the scars that led to his hated nickname, but the injury didn't keep him down for long. He was soon back at work, more dangerous than ever. In 1918, during a party at a club on Carroll Street, Capone met a tall, slim blonde named May Coughlin. She was 21, 2 years older than Capone, and worked as a sales girl in a department store in the neighborhood. Her parents, Michael Coughlin, a construction worker, and her mother, Bridget, were respected in the Irish community for their hard work and religious devotion. Now, they seemed like an odd pair, a young Italian man and an Irish girl, but in reality, this was a common thing. Despite the antagonisms between the Irish and the Italians, young Irish girls often preferred Italian men, mainly because they were willing to marry young, while Irish boys tended to wait until they were settled and secure in their occupation. John Torrio, for example, had married a young Irish girl from Kentucky named Anne McCarthy, and there are plenty of other examples of this. The wedding between May and Al took place on December 18, 1918, and was performed by Reverend James J. Delaney, pastor of the St. Mary Star of the Sea Church, where May's family worshiped. The bride's sister, Anna, and a friend of Capone's, James DeVico, were witnesses. The following year, May gave birth to their first and only child, Albert Francis, nicknamed Sonny. Torrio was his godfather, and he bought a $5,000 savings bond for Sonny every year on his birthday. At the time Capone's son was born, Torrio was spending more and more time in Chicago, where his uncle, James Big Jim Colosimo, was the biggest vice lord of the city. Although he continued to pursue ventures in New York, Chicago was now Torrio's home, and he was thriving there. Meanwhile, Capone's fortunes hadn't changed in New York, and the money he craved to care for his wife and son still eluded him. Already suspected of two murders, he faced indictment for a third if a man he sent to a hospital during a bar brawl should die. The man lived, but Capone was no longer around to hear about his recovery. A message had come from Torrio, summoning him to Chicago. So with his wife and son, he fled New York and headed west to the Windy City. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes it can feel like everyone else has it all together in their love lives. Whether married, dating, or single, the truth is most of us are still figuring it out and finding our way. Look, I get it. You hear me every week. A guy who sounds like he has it all figured out. But spoiler alert, I have no idea what I'm doing. And that's okay, because no matter where you are in your romantic journey, therapy can help you find your way, help you determine what you want, what feels heavy, and how you can take some pressure off yourself. We get it. February is full of flowers, candy, stuffed animals, fully booked restaurants, and of course, lots of talk about relationships and dating. And no matter where you are, whether you're married or dating, single, or just focusing on you, you're right on time. Therapy can help you find your way and see more clearly where you want to be. An imperfect love life is common. It's honestly how real life works because none of us are in a Hallmark movie. A little work in therapy can lead to a lot of progress. We are all still figuring it out, especially me. So will you do me a quick favor and allow yourself a moment to breathe and take some pressure off of yourself? Unclench your jaw, relax your shoulders, and go look at some pictures of puppies or something. Therapy can help you identify what's weighing your relationships down and find ways to brighten them again. Whether it's for individuals or couples, therapy is an opportunity to identify what's getting in the way and help remove any blockers. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists that work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the US. They have client reviews. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Perfect.
All right.
I don't have one. So.
All right. Well, hey, I'm ready when you are, bud.
Okay. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who often feels like having me whacked, Cody the Nose Beck. Sorry, is the best nickname I could come up with on short notice.
Well, first off the top of my head, the nose knows, okay? The nose knows.
Yeah.
Some friends call me Schnoz, which I also thought would kind of work. The Schnoz. Beekster is one that I get a lot instead of Beekster. Charlie Brockes used to do this thing with me. It's more of a visual gag, but he would say, you know, oh, did your uncle ever do that, you know, got your nose kind of thing where you put your thumb, you know, between your two fingers, but he'd say, oh, got your nose, and he'd grab my entire arm.
Whole arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So very hilarious. Proud of the nose.
Yeah, I won't keep doing that. I just
No, it's hilarious.
It's worthwhile this time, so.
It's hilarious. You should have seen it before I broke it a couple of times. It was still big, but oh boy, but Troy,
not quite as big.
Troy, first recording of 2026 for us together.
Yes. Yeah, together. Yep.
Yeah,
I've done a few nightmares, but not this first one we've done together.
So. Yeah, it's been a little while since we last got together for a show. Mm-hmm. As you are hearing this, if you're listening, you know, the day that it drops, we have a great event coming up this Saturday.
We do. Well, anytime this week, really. They don't even have to listen today.
True.
They can listen anytime. But yes, Dead of Winter is this Saturday. I know we've talked about it many, 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 many times in the past. And we talked about this year, too. But this is our 27th annual food drive event.
It's amazing.
Everybody knows it's free. You just need to bring a canned good or non-perishable item. And I've got a great message on the haunt line where someone asks specifically. So we'll get to that in a minute, but it'll be held on Saturday from 10 until 4 p.m. It will be at Franklin Lodge on Washington Avenue in Alton.
That's a new spot.
We have not done it there before. We've been doing ghost hunts and things there, and it's been part of the Alton Hauntings tours for quite a while now, but and it's been, you know, ghost hunts during some of our conferences and things. And also we just do them on a regular basis there, too. So it's a cool, very active spot. It is the Freemasons Lodge that Robert Wadlow was a member there. In fact, they've got a room dedicated to Robert Wadlow there at the lodge, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Tallest man who ever lived, if you ever need an update on that one. We've provided that as well. There'll be speakers and events all day long, a vendor room. We have books and other items will be for sale in the vendor room. There'll be a raffle for the Alton Warming Center, the overnight warming center. So there's going to be a lot going on. It's a fun day. We have collected thousands of pounds of stuff in the past. We've broken tables. So usually they need a truck to haul it away. So, and that is, you know, thanks to the generosity of the ghost people. So, you know, all of our community that comes together and does a nice thing for this. And it is a fun event, and it's, you know, the only one that you can go to that, you know, you can, you know, do something. You can do a good thing while also, you know, coming to hear ghost stories and strange tales and the unexplained and all of that stuff.
So, and a live podcast that
will be a live episode of American Hauntings being done that day. It will this year, not, it won't fit into the series this year. We're going to keep it separate. So, but it will be an episode that will be available on the 10th, I believe. So, the weekend there, Tuesday after the event. So,
yeah. And if you're going to be there, you know, if you have questions, we're going to take questions from the audience.
Yes.
We usually, y'all love to, you know, text and yell at us online, but then when we put a microphone in front of you, a little bit silent.
Yeah. It doesn't always work out so well, but you know, if you got questions, please ask them. So,
and hey, if anybody, I don't have anything official this year, but if somebody does something crazy, like if you bring like a pallet full of things, I'll give you something for free, or I'll do something,
you'll come up with something.
I'll come up with something. If you guys do some outrageous donation, like in a good way, I'll make it worth your while, and I'll do something ridiculous and fun. I'm excited for that. It's the one good thing we do here. And here it comes.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. And it is this Saturday. So, we hope to see you guys there. Like I said, doors open 10 o'clock. Well, probably open 9:30 or so, but it starts at 10 and we will be going until 4. And there's some after hour stuff, most of which is filled up, but you can always check with us when you get there. So I also found out today, this was a belated add to our what's coming up. I found out that an episode of one of the shows that I filmed last year, it's an episode called The Legend of the Werewolf for History's Greatest Mysteries, the one with Lawrence Fishburne. I did the Dillinger one last year.
Yes, yes.
I did a couple of episodes with them this year, but the werewolf episode is going to be airing next Monday, February 9th. That'll be on the History Channel, and I'm sure it'll be streaming wherever, because, I mean, who watches cable TV anymore? But if you do, or if you don't, it'll still be available out there if you want to catch it. I'll post something about it on Facebook sometime later this week.
Awesome.
I just found out literally today. So another thing that's happened since our last episode is that Haunted America conference tickets have gone on sale. And I feel a little bit bad not talking directly to our podcast folks about that, because a lot of the after hour events are almost completely full. There's several of them that have like one and two spots left already. Things have really filled up this year. It's kind of a reversal of, you know, how it sometimes is, where we, you know, we go and it gets closer and then it fills up, but it's already filling up now. But those after hour events, the tours, the ghost hunts, the workshops, all of those are going, and a lot of them are nearly full. So if you're hoping to take part in other parts of the conference, just rather than just general admission, you really don't want to wait much longer to do that. So you can Google search Haunted America Conference, or you can just go to ghostconference.net and get on board with that. And just one last thing. I want to thank everybody again, this time on the podcast, not through email or Facebook posts. I want to thank everybody on the podcast for all their help with getting the American Oddities Museum moved back in December.
Yes.
We are reopened. We opened back up on the 17th, which was great, 17th and 18th. And then the next weekend, we were closed because it snowed. So that was a bummer. But we are open again now. So I just wanted to say thank you to everyone publicly who came out to help us move, who donated to the cause, who sent money to help out with food and lunch and all that kind of stuff. So if you're in the area, or if you're coming to town for dead of winter, please come by, see the new space, check out the new exhibits and displays. We've got a much larger bookstore and gift shop too, and we're adding to that all the time. So It's been an adventure already. Just trying to figure out all the ins and outs in the new building. And yes, the bathroom is finally open. If you were here last weekend and we went, sorry, we don't have a bathroom yet. We got our water turned on and then we got it turned off again because of the cold. And then anyway, things are up and running. So we are running again. So please come by and see us. If you saw the place before, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised with the new location. If you've never seen it before, you won't know the difference, but I think you'll like it anyway. So anyway, come by, check it out. You can find your way to everything we offer, the museum, dinners, tours, Dead of Winter, Haunted America Conference, everything at AmericanHauntings.net. So
awesome. I will say I was there to help a little bit. I didn't lift a bunch of heavy things because I didn't want to, but I was there.
Just didn't like that you got caught on video just standing there while we were moving that giant life-size Robert Wadlow
stuff. Okay. Did you not see me stuck in the corner of that for a minute? Just being in the way.
I'm just kidding.
But one thing I'll say is at one point I had to go empty the vacuum. And so I went out back and there's a dumpster and I took the filter off and dumping stuff and everything falls into the dumpster from the vacuum filter. And it's pretty deep down in there. So I took two, what I found were the for fluorescent light bulbs and kind of use them as like big chopsticks. And it took me a little while, but I finally got everything out of the dumpster. And I was so annoyed after that. It was fun.
Pretty big dumpster.
Yeah. And the place looks great. And I went through the tour myself and everything. And you had some really great stickers and stuff. This like merch I'd never seen before, which was awesome.
A lot of new stuff. And more coming, but we're getting there.
Yeah. So go check it out and, go check out Robert. He's looking over the city. So you'll like it. Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to some of those events and I'll actually be at the Valentine's Day one myself.
Oh yeah. I saw that. I saw that pop up. Cool.
Got some tickets. So I'm excited. Yeah. I'd like to give a shout out to our new supporters on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Jenny, Abigail, Holly, Maddie, Rachel, Charity, Stacy, Joe, Natalie, Kat, Kevin, Kristen, Garrett, Josh, Jen, Jacob, Sarah, Kate, Bethany and Audra. It's been a minute since we've done this.
It has been a bit.
We got a lot of new supporters.
Yeah. If you're familiar with our Patreon program, or if you're not, we've got 5 seasons of an alternative podcast for you to binge on our Patreon page. We're in the middle of our 6th season right now, which is about the Starved Rock murders of 1960. We are around probably a little past the halfway mark. I've already got the next season planned, but this one's still got some interesting stuff to cover before we get out of it. So anyway, we offer that show every other week. And so you can get it along with special discounts and shirts and advanced sales and more as a Patreon supporter. And you can check that out and become one at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
That's awesome. And I've been corresponding with people that get the shirts every other month.
Yeah.
And a few people reached out and said, hey, we got all caught up. Thank you. Everybody should be on the same page. And I want to make some new stuff, some new shirts, some new merch. So if anybody has any ideas, hit us up. Social media or American Hauntings Podcast at gmail.com or anything. If anybody has ideas, I'm not going to say I'll do them, but I'll read them.
Yeah, I'm working on some American Nightmares stuff too.
Yeah.
I've got some new museum shirts that I'm getting ready to put up. So I'm kind of getting that together. So we got a couple of different things going on with different stuff.
Yeah.
Cody will have all the podcast stuff on his side. Mm-hmm. I'll have the nightmare stuff on my side along with the museum. So yeah, it's going to be pretty cool. So I'll put up some links to that and some information about it once things get up and rolling.
Awesome. Well, there are two other things I wanted to call out real quick. I wanted to give a shout out to Charlie Brockes, who again has written our transition song for this season. He wrote music for the first couple seasons and just kind of randomly throughout there and did a good job with this new one. So the song you heard just before, after Troy's monologue and before this, that would be from him. So thanks, buddy. He also gave us a PA, so that was really cool. So thanks, man.
Yeah.
And something else, just the last thing, Troy, I want to shout out the podcast network that we've launched and are expanding. And we're basically adding more shows that are in, in this universe. And that I think that people, if you like our podcast, we think that you'll like these podcasts, and it's expanding, and you don't have to change a thing. Just keep, listening to episodes on this feed, and you'll be able to tell from the artwork which show is which. And I'm excited.
Me too. It's been fun. I've done, I guess, like 10 episodes of American Nightmares so far. And I've enjoyed just doing something outside of, what we normally do, just something a little bit different. And I've got the next one's the first one with a warning label on it.
Oh, boy.
It'll be all right. So it's just a little more graphic than usual. But, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. So that's episode 11.
I'm very curious. I'm intrigued now. I wanted to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners who left a review on iTunes. So thank you very much to Garrett D5150. And this review is titled 10 Stars. It says, if 10 stars were available, that's what I would rate it. Troy is the definition of well-researched and separates legend from lore. In the post-narration discussion, Cody asked the questions we are all wondering and some I wouldn't even think to ask. This duo is super engaged with their listeners, and that speaks volumes to the kind of community they have built. Been listening since season 3 and won't be stopping anytime soon. Well, thank you very much, Garrett. That means a lot. I'm glad you're enjoying the show.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and Garrett or anyone else who hears us read their review, if you will text us your address on the hotline at 217-791-7859, we will send you something cool in the mail. Just give us a little time. I've got a lot of new things coming that we've gotten as the museum is open, but I've got some neat stuff coming from both American Hauntings and from the Oddities Museums. So, and I'm sending that stuff out to people in the mail. So yeah, just be sure to send us your address on the hotline, and we'll get you something cool.
Sweet.
It's a bribe, but whatever. So it just makes it easier for people to find us. That's really all it is. Well, it's Cody's ego. We have to stroke it every once in a while, but really it's just to get people.
Okay.
It's easier to find us.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. Glad to take after 10 seasons. I know how you finally feel. Okay. Are you ready to dive in this episode? I know this is one of your favorite
things in the entire world. It is. And it's one of those things where, obviously I'm kind of taking my time with it considering how we started, but this will be one of those seasons where I'm going to hate to end it, and I'm not sure how I'm going to do it, but it's going to be fun. And it's not even that I just love Al Capone himself so much. I like the whole era. I like everything about it. It's just such an interesting era, and it's just such a weird time in American history that, that it's like one of those, it can't happen here things, and then it does. And yet, on the other hand, while a stupid law, it's thank goodness we had it, because it's given me so much material, that we had that I can write about with Prohibition and all the gangsters and everything. So yes, I do love this stuff. So you are right on that.
So was this one of your, I have to imagine this is probably one of your favorite books to write, right? I mean,
it was, yeah, it was. And I did an original edition of this came out in like 2010. I wrote a book about this stuff, but I've since updated it quite a bit, and the episode isn't going to be just, the episodes aren't going to be just the book, I've got other stuff I'm already filling in, but I've already done it in the first episode. I've changed all kinds of things around, but anyway, it is one of my favorite topics to write about, one of my favorite things to write about, and getting to do a Chicago season is a lot of fun, but I didn't want it to be just like, here's all the haunted places in Chicago. I mean? I mean, we did that and it was fun in St. Louis. It was fun in New Orleans and stuff. But Chicago, there's different ways that you can go. And so I think there are multiple, I mean, maybe it's just because I love Chicago so much, but I think there's multiple seasons that Chicago can produce.
Depending on how you slice it. Yeah.
Yeah. This is definitely going to be one I think that will be my favorite.
So. Yes. So the book is Blood, Guns, and Valentines. Yeah. Is mm-hmm. that, yes. So check it out. The Roaring Twenties. I know you've loved this stuff for so long, and it was a huge thing that got you into true crime. And I know that I feel like if you could go back, you would be fine being like, I don't know if this is the right nomenclature, but being a Pinkerton or being like one of Al Capone's like crew. Like, I think you just love to be in that era.
Yeah, I think I'd just want to be in there somewhere. Sure. And if not the 20s, then I know we've talked about this a million times, but definitely, I mean, I don't want to live through the Depression, but on the other hand, I want to be John Dillinger. So,
yes,
you know, it's like, what's the catch? So I don't know. I do enjoy the everything about the era, and I'm excited to get to do this season of the podcast. I really am, because there's so much story here to tell. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of stuff that people don't know that hopefully they'll learn. I mean, it's just so funny, just basic stuff about like Capone. Everybody who plays him, if you see him played in something, he's always short. Dude was like over 6 feet tall, built like an ox. But yet we look at him and we think, oh, he's this short little guy, you know, because Stephen Graham plays him in Boardwalk Empire and he's a short dude. So you think, oh, he's short, you know. Even De Niro played him in The Untouchables and he's not that tall either. But the other funny thing, which is then the direct thing to what I want to mention next, mm-hmm. is how young this guy was.
Yeah.
I mean, De Niro's playing him. He's like in his 40s, right? And, you know, the guy is 25 years old when he takes over, you know, the entire Chicago operation. I mean, he's become a multimillion dollar 25 years old. I mean, it's crazy, you know, and people just don't realize young he was. He looks old. He looks older.
Well, so he does look old. And so, okay, I got a lot of questions here with this.
Okay.
Let's dive into it. So Scarface, right?
Yes.
And you think about that, and then there's Scarface, the movie.
Sure, so, which is based on, Scarface, the original Scarface film that came out, I believe Howard Hawks did it back in the 30s. And that was based on Capone. Well, the Scarface with Al Pacino is
83. Yeah.
Right. Also based on, it's a remake. Technically, it's a remake. It's just they moved the action to Florida and made it about cocaine instead of, you know, booze. Mm-hmm. And then he became essentially the same type of character, although he definitely spins out even more than Capone did.
That's what I was thinking.
But don't worry, it's coming. There are plenty of times. There's a plenty of things that people don't even know about that Capone did that we don't think about because we just see these guys in the suits and you'd think it's the 20s and you know you don't. You know, it's not like that. It's really not.
So do we only think of him as a small man because of how he's been portrayed in?
I think so. I think, you know, even in the photographs, you know, he looks older than he was. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, you know, one, I mean, he's losing some of his hair. But even that's not a big deal. It's more the fact that, you know, he grew up in extreme poverty. So, and part of the reason why I think if you look back at people, you know, pre-1960 or whatever, they all look older than they were.
Sure.
I mean, when you look at it and you think, oh, well, here's a guy, you know, that, and because people started their lives a lot earlier than they do. Well,
nutrition, stress, work,
all those things. And, you know, you're getting married and having kids at 19, you know, and your wife's a stay-at-home homemaker. You know, she's a housewife and you go and work at a job that can pay for a new car, a new house and put your kids through school. You know, it was a different time,
right?
You know, and people had to grow up a lot faster than they do now. Yeah. And I think that's part of it, too. But you know, probably a lot of the, you know, he partied pretty hard.
Sure.
As we'll hear, too.
Worked hard, play hard.
Yeah, I mean, people, again, you don't think about it because it's the 1920s, but here's a guy who's banging, you know, hookers, you know, who are, you know, working for his
brothels, sex workers.
Okay, yeah, ends up with syphilis and, you know, untreated for years that he doesn't even know he had. This dude,
like Hitler.
This dude hoovered so much coke that probably didn't help him look any younger.
Sure.
But then there's the booze. I mean, there's just it was a hard living life.
Yeah.
Plus, there's a lot of stress considering that, you know, he had guys trying to kill him on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so especially after, well, we'll get to that. So
yes, and after all that, it's not going to be
There's a lot to come. This was just the start. So
there is a lot. So I'm wondering where did his, I mean, I don't think audacity is not the right word. Confidence and charisma and everything. How did that, is it just a perfect storm of stuff where he just like, I'm going into this room, I'm controlling it, and I'm doing stuff. Like,
I just think,
you know,
he's
one of a kind.
I think he was a go-getter. He was a smart aleck. I mean, you know, when he was in school, you know, he got good grades till he got bored. You know, I think
hit his teacher.
Really smart, you know, knocked the teacher down. I think, you know, he even living in this horrible conditions that he was living in, he found himself, you know, thanks to like John Torrio kind of taking him under his wing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was introduced to a lot of guys who he's seeing are, you know, wearing nice clothes and they got plenty of money to spend on, you know, women, wine and song. And I think he just decided this is for me. This is what I'm going to do. And he was cocky enough to do it. Plus, again, he's not a small man. He's big and
he's intimidating.
Talk about him being bull-like. So he was very intimidating. He was tough. He was, you know, willing to use a gun or a knife, you know, whatever he was told to do, he was doing it because he knew that that was the way that he was going to build himself up and someday be working for himself. Now, do I think he ever thought he'd be, you know, the head of an organization that literally ran the city of Chicago? Probably not. My guess would be that he probably thought that he would be somebody like, you know, like Kelly, like Paul Kelly, the guy he, you know, kind of knew about that used to run the Five Points gang. I think he probably thought that, you know, he'd be somebody like that, you know, that he maybe run a gang or something, but or, you know, maybe thought he was going to be John Torrio for that matter, you know, who was a guy who was working his way up.
Yep.
And, you know, he was Torrio's sidekick, you know, he would be eventually for at least a few years. And, you know, we'll get to that once we get to Chicago, because next episode will be, you know, we'll be covering exactly how they ended up in Chicago and how they, well, what they did when they got there, let's put it that way.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so, who they did when they got there, I guess would be a better way to phrase it.
Because I don't know. I don't know a lot about that yet.
Yeah.
But I mean, hey, if you're pushing and trying to go up the ranks and stuff and you just keep succeeding and keep succeeding, like, why not? Just keep going, keep going until you hit some kind of limit. But something interesting I thought was that you talk about crime families, kind of the Italians a lot got closer because they kind of had to. They were a minority.
Sure.
And you know, strength in numbers,
badly
sort of thing.
Mistreated, prejudice against. I did an episode of American Nightmares about immigrants a couple weeks ago. And, you know, and again, talked about how the Irish and the Italians were the most poorly treated of all of them, you know. And the Italians had it tough because a lot of them didn't speak English for starters. You know, and that was something that, I mean, not like Capone and his brothers and sisters. I mean, they were born here, but like his parents, you know, the English was their second language. You know, his mother never spoke great English. You know, so that was the case of a lot of immigrants who came over. At least the Irish, you know, we had our version of English.
Right.
Anyway, but yeah, you know, and so you get involved in a handful of things. There's only so many things you can do. With the Irish, they were given job. They were cops and they became firefighters and gangsters, but they became cops and firefighters. It was a job nobody wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was the same way with the Italians. They, you know, they ended up with much worse jobs because they didn't even speak English. So they're a rung below the Irish.
Right.
And so you end up with jobs, you know, and, you know, lousy jobs. And you look around and you see these guys who are, you know, committing crimes, you know, or as they would later say, giving the people what they wanted. And so these guys are succeeding. So it's not really a surprise that even though Italian gangsters were in the minority of Italians, that's the way everybody saw them.
And right.
I talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah. The monologue. Yeah. Yeah. That seems to rise to the top as far as like in people's minds. And something it's interesting is Capone didn't really care about Italy. He cared about Brooklyn. And I imagine if you're trying to learn English and the people that are teaching you have Brooklyn accents, that's going to be very difficult.
Also difficult. Yeah.
It'd be very difficult. And then you mentioned the completion of the Williamsburg Bridge in 1903, the greatest suspension bridge in the world at that time, brought hordes of people to the area looking for cheap housing. You know, I love bridges. And I lived in New York, and so I visited this bridge, it was amazing. It was one of my favorite bridges.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Then talked about a teacher who seems like just a badass young lady, a 16-year-old named Sadie
Mulvaney. 16-year-old teacher, isn't that great?
Yeah, right?
Sadie Mulvaney. So
and
sounds like a Billy Joel song.
It kind of does.
You know, Sadie Mulvaney had to work at the docks.
Speaking of the docks,
the good die young. You know,
Capone liked to watch the Navy people and the discipline. He got a lot of things. I guess how to run maybe a group of people.
Maybe. He was fascinated with watching these guys, you know, have to be put through their paces, and you know, he had a kind of an admiration for, you know, the sergeant who's kind of running the show, but he didn't have much use for some of the recruits, the dumb ones anyway. So.
Yes.
Which is pretty funny considering that he's still just a kid, but he's a big kid, you know, and he's not afraid of anybody. That's the other thing. And see, that's the kind of stuff when you were asking me, you know, how did this end up? You're born with that. That's something you're born with, I think. And I think
the fearlessness,
that fearlessness and that attitude that he had. I mean, some of that, of course, is shaped by his surroundings. But, you know, here was a case of where you're living in a place where you're beat down on a regular basis kind of thing, as far as, you know, education and housing and food and everything.
How you look and what you speak.
You got to make up for it somewhere. And man, he did.
Yes. And so John Torrio, small guy, takes Capone under his wing, but Torrio teaches him, I guess, more strategy and stuff because he doesn't fire guns, doesn't like violence.
Yeah. We'll talk more about that as we go, because he, for the longest time, it was John that really reined him in, because Capone's a hothead and, you know, he enjoyed watching the military discipline, but it didn't really appeal to him. You know, he wanted to be the guy in charge. He didn't want to be the guy taking orders, but he had respect for Torrio and for some of the others too. And I think that's probably, you know, it was good for a long time that John really kind of kept him reined in. And it once he was out of the game and Capone was in charge, that's when the beer war started. That's when the assassination started. That's when all the blood really started to fly.
Yeah.
But like I said, we'll get to that down the road.
Of course. You mentioned how some of the gangs around him weren't criminal. And I love to talk more about this because just as a young man working, having sports teams, Boy Scouts, things like that, the groups that I could of peers, like that was very important in shaping me way more than I understood at the time.
And a lot of that stuff didn't really exist in that way at the time. I mean, as far as organized sports for just like kids off the street, no, there wasn't a lot of that. Not kids growing up, immigrants growing up in the tenements, but social clubs, that's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of immigrant groups had social clubs where they could gather with their people, so to speak. And a lot of that was aimed toward younger kids and younger guys. So that way they had someplace to go. They could let off a little steam, you know, they could have some fun. They could play stickball. They could do whatever, you know, but you know, a lot of that stuff, then it's still a lot of it in a lot of cases is still bordered on criminal, because most of them were supported. As I mentioned in this, they were supported by these, you know, politicians and things. And these politicians, there was a reason they were supporting them, because they knew they could count on them when election day rolled around to go out and get the votes. And going out and getting the votes in those days was not like, you know, you weren't campaigning. You were telling people how to vote or you were going to kick their ass. That kind of stuff. So they were, but they were also appealing to, you know, knowing that here I've got you know, this Irish social club, you know, I'm giving these guys sporting goods equipment and I'm, you know, letting them go out to dinner and stuff. Their neighborhood is going to vote for the way I want them to vote because they're loyal to me. I'm loyal to them. They're loyal to me. And I mentioned that a lot with the Italians is, you know, the loyalty was the number one thing. And, you know, a lot of the gangs, even the social clubs, were only for Sicilians or only for, you know, Neapolitans.
And okay,
it wasn't necessarily, they didn't always mix just general Italians together. But, you know, for a long time, to get into the Cosa Nostra, you had to be a Sicilian. You could not be made if you were a made. And there's
a good fellas
that when we talk about the Unioni is, you know, the blood ritual and things that
have
to be done. And that all became a part of, you know, the real, what we would consider to be the mafia, like you'd see in The Godfather.
That sure.
kind of mafia. Not like, you know, The Sopranos or something.
Right.
You know, it's funny, you know, and I don't know if we'll really get into that, but it's funny that, you know, the more modern version of the mafia, you know, a lot of the stuff they picked up wasn't stuff that dated back decades or hundreds of years or anything. It was stuff they picked up from like The Godfather. Serious.
Well, so can you know. Well, that's the thing. Can you set me straight? Is it because I grew up believing that the mafia was a set of like multiple families that all ran crime things and then sometimes worked together.
Yeah, we'll get into that because like the five families in New York were, you know, and Frankie Yale and there's still a lot of that to come.
Okay.
We're gonna get to all that. But, you know, and I may have to do something to kind of show a comparison between New York and Chicago, too. But New York had these five Italian families and they would work together unless
when it benefited them.
Somebody crossed each other. Yes. But see, John Torrio tried to do that in Chicago, too, except it wasn't just Italian gangs. It was all the gangs. And for about 4 years, it worked really well.
That's crazy.
And we'll get back to that. We that is coming.
Yeah.
So you'll understand a little bit better, you know, how things were separated and that kind of thing.
Fair enough.
The reason that I spent so much time on the Unioni Siciliani is because that's going to play a pretty important role in Chicago as well.
Yes. I'm going to get to that in just a second. And one thing I love is the Frankie Yale quote of "I'm an undertaker." I thought that was brutal as hell.
And it's a pretty good one. Yeah.
And for anybody
he'll be buried himself before long. So
and anybody that
nobody gets out of these episodes alive. Not in the end. So
and perfect. You know. So anybody that wonders, my Nona, her last name was Benoni. So come at me.
Are you going to say you came by that nose naturally? Is that what you're going to try to tell
me? You know, I don't know if that's the Italian part or if that's some of the.
I know that's a stereotype, and I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I am just giving you a hard time.
And I do have a big nose, and that's the only part of my background that I've mentioned. So I don't think it's bad at all. Okay, but last thing we're really going to talk about, though, is introducing that at the Unioni Siciliani.
Yes, that's close enough.
Unioni. Yeah.
Let me handle it. I finally got it down. I've been working on that one for years.
Okay.
So, I mean, it took me a long time to perfect that one.
And we've been working on pronunciations, too. We're trying to respect.
We have.
It's a thing you guys have said, so we're trying to work on it.
I know. Yeah. Yes, we have.
So. But basically, huge orgs with their hands and everything crime.
Yeah. Right.
Is that fair enough?
Yeah, that's fair enough. You know, I mean, it did start out to be, you know, a fraternal order. I mean, it was supposed to be just a, you know, like a social thing. They were supposed to be for Italians that you could get life insurance and stuff like that. And then there were different branches. It was kind of an Italian Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the mob gets into everything if they find that there's a way to make money. That's, you know, how they got into all the labor unions eventually.
Yep, the racketeers.
They needed some place to go after, you know, well, even during Prohibition, but especially after Prohibition, you needed some way to make more money, and the labor unions were great. And so this thing just started off as something, you know, it was a good thing. And so that, you know, but there was money to be made that became kind of a dual purpose. And so even the guys that were, you know, the upstanding guys that were part of it, like the guy who, you know, gives this, you know, Constantino Vitelli's just talking about, you know, oh, we're strong business and professional men. We don't, you know, no gangsters allowed. And, you know, at that point, Frankie Yale had been the head of the union for 6 years.
Right.
So, I mean, come on. They knew, you know, they knew.
They
so
knew.
That's the way it was. So,
yeah. 60 murders tied to them in 6 years. but we talk about the, can we talk about the blood ritual though? Required to join?
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, it was, it is pretty much like, you know, you've seen the movies where you've got to, you know, you prick your blood and then you, you know, you mix it with the other guys.
That oh, that's all it was?
And yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, there's a an oath and things you have to take that, you know, they don't usually print that, but you had to swear loyalty to the organization. I mean, it was essentially just like, you know, being a becoming a made man, as they called it, you know, later on.
Only way out's through a box or whatever, like that kind
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, you don't just walk away, right?
Got it. And so Capone meets May Coughlin, who's 21, who at 21 is 2 years older than Capone. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
They marry in 1918, and then eventually...
Yeah, they both lied on their marriage certificate because she was embarrassed. So he upped a year and she dropped a year.
That's but, amazing,
you know, but yeah, her parents were just regular Irish immigrants. Her dad was a construction worker. Her mom was a, you know, housewife that people knew, but they didn't really, they didn't have a problem with it.
Was that rare?
Both Catholic. No, not at all. They're both Catholic. So, I mean, that was good. And, you know, Italian guys marrying Irish girls, that actually became a thing. I mean, that became a very common thing.
Okay.
And I guess the only, and I mentioned this, but the only explanation for it that anybody's been able to come up with is that, you know, the Irish girls didn't have mustaches. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm just joking.
You're not wrong.
The only excuse they could come up with is that because Italian guys were more than willing to get married young. And these girls all wanted to get married and get out of the house and have kids.
Oh.
And so marrying an Irish guy, you know, you couldn't count on him. You never knew when he was going to want to get married. And so they'd marry these Italian guys. And there's a lot of them. You'll hear more of them as we go. Even I mentioned John Torrio, just for instance, was married to an Irish girl.
And, wow.
She was Irish, too. So, yeah, it was just kind of one of those things that had happened quite a bit.
That happened. And,
Capone was a you know, good example of that.
Right. So. Well, I can't wait to hear what happens when he flees to Chicago after being summoned by Torrio. But for right now, that's all I got. Is there anything else that you want to go over this? I think we're set up.
We're good.
Well, hey, I don't have any Ghostwriter emails this week, but hey, if
it's a little early. So, I mean, I've got a couple of old,
hotline
things that because, I mean, this is our first episode.
So, sure.
You know, we've been off for a while and some of them I tried to answer when I could, but some of them were a little bit old, but I've got a few here that are kind of fun. So.
Sure. Well, real quick, I just want to let people know you can either go, you know, text on the hotline, which Troy will talk about in a minute, but if you want to send a comment or a quick question that you'd like to have answered, you can email me at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. But right now we're going to go to the hotline that Troy's talking about where it gets text messages.
Yeah, you can text us on the hotline at 217-791-7859. And it may get read on the air, or I may try to answer it. And I'm terrible about checking it, but I do always get around to checking it. So don't give up if it seems like a long time, because Jeremy LaGrange sent me this message in December.
Beautiful.
So, you know, but he said, I've been meaning to text and congratulate you on the expansion. I'm really enjoying both new shows. Also, congratulations on the conclusion of season 9. I especially enjoyed this past season's premise. Already looking forward to the next one. So anyway, speaking of films, any Christmas horror movies you could recommend? Now, we did a whole...
I think
there was a bonus episode a few years ago, I think.
I'm pretty sure.
There is, on Christmas horror movies. I know there is.
A bunch of Krampus shit.
We talked about them from Krampus to the Advent calendar. I mean, there's some good ones out there. And it seems like there's more every year. People have really, after Krampus really jumped in, I think people really started getting excited about that. But anyway, he mentioned that the 1951 adaptation of Dickens' A Christmas Carol, he thinks is pretty spooky. And I would agree with that. I used to watch that on Christmas Eve every year and when I was a kid. And I thought that one was pretty spooky. So anyway, for what it's worth, you've sold me on Halloween being the beginning of spooky season rather than the end. And have found myself looking for holiday and winter related horror movies the past couple of years. For example, during an unusually cold winter about a year ago, I first discovered The Black Coat's Daughter, which is one I've talked about quite a bit. It's Oz Perkins. I think it was his first film. And I love that movie. I just rewatched it again.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good one. Well, I don't know. You may not like it because it's slow.
Okay.
It's slow paced.
All right.
Well, you always complain to me because I'll give you something to watch. You'll go, move any faster, you know, but
that's very much me.
Yeah, you should try it. I think you would like it. I really do.
I'll check it out. I'll check it out.
So, and this one came in the same day from Tim Biggs. And Tim writes this on a regular basis, but he says, it's been a while since I texted or saw you. It's been a rough year. Oh, well, I'll leave that. That's kind of personal for him. But I look forward to seeing the new digs of the museum. So I did have a question. We just finished House of Guinness on Netflix. Obviously very fictional. Do you think anyone would ever do a series on the Limps? They should. He said, ooh. I would watch it. Here's wishing you a great new year to you and Cody.
Thank you.
That would be cool. I mean, I think that would be a cool way to cover it is by doing it as a sort of mini series, you know. I think that would be kind of cool.
It's got enough drama and oh, stuff yeah, in it.
Plenty of stuff. So yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Cool. Yeah. So all right. This one comes to us from let's see. This one comes to us and it is mentioned about the Mark of the Werewolf movie. I think we talked about that here and there. April 11th at the Melba Theater in DeSoto, Missouri, having an event for the movie Mark of the Werewolf. Brian Clark, an actor in the film, and Dennis Vincent, the creator and director, will be at the event for photo ops and autographs, and they'll have Blu-rays available.
Oh, nice.
So, but yeah, I did want to mention that it is April 11th. So if you're down that way, yeah, I gave him a real slow reply, but I it sent like 2 weeks later, but it was in the middle of the move. So, I mean, I had a good excuse, but
where is it going to be again?
It's in DeSoto, Missouri at the Melba Theater. And they're doing a showing of the movie. It starts at 10 PM, doors open at 9:30. Tickets are only $7.50. I think it would be a lot of fun. And, so anyway, he wrote back to say, hey, just heard the trailer for the next season. I'm totally excited. My great grandfather was a bootlegger in the St. Louis area and part of the Cuckoo Gang, which will get mentioned, believe it or not, later on. Because of this connection and the fact that my grandmother would never talk about her childhood and fear of being arrested for it, I love all things mob and gang related. I know the season 10 is Chicago, but are you going to maybe do St. Louis in the future? It will get mixed in some because there is some crossover there, believe it or not. Some of my grandfather's dealings are in have been written about in St. Louis gangs books. So
nice.
Yeah. So this one is comes to us from the 678. And it says, two words for the latest episode of American Nightmares. Thank you. There are so many assumptions about how we got to this place or what it has always been. I know people learn a lot from the history you share. That my last episode was about, this was The Devil May Pay. And it was about the devilish, demonic connotations the 19th century put on, mostly on women, and women's health care and abortion. And it talks about a murder that happened because of that. I like to tie a lot of things together.
But yeah,
there were so many uses of the devil, and that's kind of what we're covering for now. In the episodes, devil related stuff, and then we'll get into more of that soon. I'm starting to creep into the 20th century now, so
I love it.
But it's been a lot of fun, doing it. So, but yeah, that was kind of a fun one to do. So, I mean, considering that it ends with someone being beheaded and their body not being,
yeah, I like, anyway, I like to remember it. Sometimes it's not the devil, sometimes people are just fucking terrible.
It definitely is. So all right, so this one comes to us from one of our regular listeners and one of our regular folks, Shannon in the 630. And this is the one I mentioned that has to do with Dead of Winter. And
okay.
I thought this was something that we could all, or everybody listening could get some information from. So it says, hey, Tori and Cody, quick question about Dead of Winter. My husband and I are finally attending gathering goods for donation. I wanted to know if any of the places being donated to wanted anything other than food. Example, some of our food pantries here also want items like socks or female care items, things most of us don't know about or think about for donation. And I thought I'd check. And yes, that's a definite yes.
Absolutely.
We often will get a lot of donations of, you know, toilet paper, light bulbs. I mean, things you might not think about, but things that you would buy at the grocery store. And so that kind of falls in the same thing with the food banks. They need that kind of stuff too. So yes. In addition to canned goods and mac and cheese and non-perishables, those kinds of things are also great. Toilet paper, you know, you name it. There's lots of things that can be used. So just definitely use your imagination and think, what would I buy if I went to Walmart and I needed it? Or what would I need from Walmart if I had no money to get it? So,
Yes. And so also kind of where we're at. We also talked about this is kind of relevant, but if you're going to get snowed in for a few days or something, what stuff
you'd need.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So anyway, that is the end of our Hauntline messages for this time. So if you do have something that you'd like to comment or have a question that you want to send us on the Hauntline, it's 217-791-7859. So thanks.
All right. You ready to take us out?
Yeah, y'all set? Sure. Okay.
Good to go.
Well, thanks again for checking out the story in the postmortem for this week's episode of American Hauntings, which is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. We hope you love this show along with the other shows of the network. And if you do, we hope you'll tell other people you think might love them and encourage them to listen. If you get a chance, leave us a review wherever you listen, which makes it easier for people to find us. Also, don't forget that as an American Hauntings listener, you can use the discount code PODCAST for 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Because, just remember, American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful. This episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the Hauntline, or on Facebook and Instagram, where we're often hanging out. Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
We'll see you later.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.